Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies where we read and discuss foundational texts and key ideas that inform the way we think about organized work today. Talking About Organizations is a community resource graciously supported through contributions by our listeners. To find out more about our program and how you can help, visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com or stick around to the end for more information. Now, on with the show. Welcome to episode 125, where we will discuss an article from Stephen Barley titled Technology as an Occasion for Structuring, Evidence from Observations of CT Scanners and the Social Order of Radiology Departments, published in Administrative Science Quarterly in 1986. To learn more about the text, please go to our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com.
Hi, this is Rohin from London.
Hi, this is Greta from beautiful Dordrecht in the Netherlands.
And this is Tom from Carlisle, Pennsylvania in the United States. Welcome, everybody, and welcome to our third episode in which we are including the works of Stephen Barley. We have previously included him in one of our professional development workshops or symposia about the meaning of work. And we also, as a follow-on to that, we included in episode 103, where he and Gideon Kunda talked about bringing work back in. Today, we're going to look at Stephen Barley, his individual work, one of his early works, in which he's really focused on institutions and the interaction between institutions and the activities that people perform in the workplace. So we're going back to one of his early works, 1986. This is Technology as an Occasion for Structuring, Evidence from Observations of CT Scanners and the Social Order of Radiology Departments, which is a follow-on from his dissertation work in which he studied the interactions between radiologists and CT technologists as a new technology entered a couple of hospitals. And so this article came out in Administrative Science Quarterly in 1986 and is a precursor for a lot of his later work. So what we'll do is we'll talk a little bit about the later work later in this episode. But here, what we're really focused on is what he proposed, based on the empirical study he performed, proposed a model of interaction between actions and institutions that has probably been seen a lot in people's PhD programs and organization studies.
Yeah, I mean, speaking of seeing it during PhD programs, it was a paper that I read during my PhD. And as I was telling you, Tom, before we got started here, revisiting the paper has almost increased my appreciation for it because of the underpinnings that I'm more aware of now in terms of what was going on in sociology at the time, in qualitative methods at the time. Just as by way of a quick introduction to the paper, it is at its core, let's say, kind of what is now a standard way of going about doing some ethnographic research where you've got, you know, two hospitals, both are introducing this new technology, and then you go in and observe differences and patterns or trajectories across the two and try to theorize from that. But what's underpinning this paper is a lot of work in terms of bringing in this more constructivist view to organizations, drawing on a lot of sociological theories that we'll talk about, such as structuration and negotiated order, explaining the qualitative method. There's an interesting hybridity to the paper as well, in terms of there's a lot of counting and regressions going on towards the end, which perhaps is an artifact of the time when he was trying to publish this. But it is this combination of paper where you've got a simple kind of idea and takeaway, but also a lot of dense work going into it to craft it in the way it appears.
Yes, Tom, I also encountered this paper during my PhD studies. And revisiting it, building upon what Rohin already mentioned, you really see like how much work had to be done to justify this study. I don't know who the reviewers were of this paper, but you know, not only having a large upfront rhetoric about why current assumptions of the impact of technology and organizational structure were wrong in terms of, you know, three wrong assumptions, but also, you know, going into that the entire way of studying it from the outside rather than looking in and looking at the actual work that is happening. So definitely, you know, Steve Barley has done the groundwork for us, making qualitative work more acceptable and also showing the value of that type of work.
And as for me, I did not encounter this paper in my studies. My studies actually started with Barley and Tolbert, 1997, which is a paper, and I mean literally, my program started with Barley and Tolbert. That was the first paper read in my foundations class. And so the Barley and Tolbert paper is sort of like the follow-on to this, a more of a generalization of this particular study. But what makes it kind of interesting there is that from somebody coming in who did not have any organizational studies background at the time, words like institutionalization, structuration, and the sociological version of action was a bit confusing to me. So I did not fully grasp that paper. So now that I've read this one, just like you both, I've gotten a much greater appreciation for what Stephen Barley had been trying to do later in his career.
Great. And actually, just for the readers, I think this paper should really be read in parallel to his 1990 publication, which is using the same data set and goes way more deeper into his methodology of doing role analysis and how he analyzes how the roles and role relations between the technicians and the radiologists changes over time. So here it's really about, you know, embedding it in structuration theory, in showing how institutions are changing based upon changes in the patterns of work due to new technology. The other one focuses much more on the relations, how the relations between the technologies and the engineers changed. So here it also comes to the fore in the findings, but the other one is a very nice follow-up, I think.
Good. So maybe we should start with kind of the backdrop of what's going on and how he then frames this study before getting into a bit more of the theory and the methodology. So, I mean, at the core, again, this was his dissertation work. So one can presume the interest was in, you know, he would have intentionally studied this technology introduction in these two hospitals. And so studying the domain of research on technology and organizations. And a large part of the work there was what we might now call technological determinism. And so the work in this kind of 60s and 70s, economists like Joan Woodward, some sociologists like Chuck Perrow, and even some of the work of org theorists like James Thompson, although not necessarily talking about new technology in terms of equipment, but even if you think of the nature of work as a technology, the nature of one's tasks, the idea of technological determinism is that the complexity of your tasks, the nature of the interdependence, etc., will determine the structure of the organization. So how hierarchical you are, how information flows, and so on and so forth. Coming into this kind of fray, Barley talks about how there's mixed results in this literature, where in some cases kind of technology does reshape the organization, in other cases it doesn't. And he does an interesting, at least analytical, move in his framing of this paper, where he says, look, people have not just recognized the contradictory results, they've also tried to explain it, but they've tended to explain it using methodological shortcomings. So maybe we're not measuring technology correctly, or were you relying on the wrong kinds of surveys or the wrong kinds of indexes? And then Barley says, maybe we can instead look at the mixed results as something to be explained theoretically. So take it as a matter of course and see if theory can help us actually cover all findings in the literature so far. So moving it kind of one step up, which is when he then brings in his idea of looking at it not as technology shapes structure, but as this structuration or structuring process that we'll discuss. But it helps for the reader slash listener to think of the idea of, let's say, technology, the title of the paper, technology as an occasion for structuring, as opposed to what? As opposed to technology as a cause for organization structure. That's where Barley's coming into the conversation.
Yeah, the specific phrase, I'll go ahead and read it at the bottom of page 78, because that was like the first thing that I starred Rather than continue to scrutinize research for additional methodological and conceptual flaws, a more fruitful ploy may be simply to embrace the contradictory evidence as a replicated finding. I love the way that he worded that. You're absolutely right. This is not mixed findings as a bug. This is mixed findings as a feature. To see that back in 1986 really paints a different picture of, you know, where we're going to take this study to try to show what is ultimately the experiences of two organization settings that introduced the same technology produced mixed results. But they actually, you know, from a more meta-analytical level, confirm the same process of action and institution that Barley will show.
That's a great one. And actually on page 79, it directly links to three assumptions that current literature on technology was mostly informed by contingency theory at the time. We have also a PDW on that. Kind of the three assumptions that he debunks with this work and why this work is so widely cited, laying the foundations for a different approach to studying technology. So first, he says that when structure has been treated as an autonomous formal constraint, three other presumptions have typically followed. One is that technology is a material cause. Two, that relations between technology and structure are orderly. And three, that these relations hold regardless of context. And what Steve's work has been widely known for is to really show the importance of context in shaping the behavior of the people in organizations and the way that work gets done. And that's exactly what he does in this paper.
Yeah, I mean, interestingly, that third assumption is one where I kind of jotted down. I'm not sure if he's potentially strawmanning the prior literature, but it doesn't matter that much for the rest of it. But where he says, again, to repeat, technology is material cause, so that is a deterministic view in the literature. These relations between tech and structure are orderly. So this, again, more like we can quantify the laws of how technology shapes org structure. But the fact that these relations hold regardless of context, I think a lot of the contingency theorists were trying to bring in context, but again, perhaps not in the meaning-laden context view that Barley would emphasize, more in terms of context, such as how complex is your environment or how uncertain is your environment and things like that. But yes, I think this is a good place to start where, and also for the reader slash listener, if you hear us quoting direct verbatim from the paper quite a bit, it's a reflection of the fact that he writes quite well. And so some of it is best expressed through his own words rather than paraphrasing. But he starts off talking about how structure, you know, people have looked at it deterministically, but a lot of this is because of one particular view of structure. And there's actually two ways of thinking about structure. He talks about how in the first usage, let me get back to a verbatim quote, still on page 79, he says, "Unlike in the first usage, in which structure stands outside of and prior to human endeavor," so structure is almost exogenous, is what he means here. He says, "In the second usage, structure is understood as an emergent property of ongoing action." So if you now change the meaning of structure from this kind of exogenous prior to human action feature to an emergent outcome of human action feature, you already start to see the necessity for what he's about to do analytically of looking at action and structure and interactions between the two. So he starts off with kind of bringing in this sociological, both are sociological perspectives, but bringing in this alternative sociological perspective on what structure even is, which then leads him to the conclusion that a full account of structural change, therefore, appears to require a synthetic view. By synthetic, he means like a synthesized view of structure as both a product of and a constraint on human endeavor.
Which then leads him to the model. And it's kind of interesting in this particular case, he's presenting his model of the mapping of structure before he gets into the empirical case. Under most circumstances, we would have expected to see the reverse. You sort of present the empirical findings and then you derive this structure. But following from what Rowan has just said, he then gives the evolution of structure, which is probably a model that we see in other literature as sort of like the basis of this idea of scripts, and where over time you have these two parallel realms is the term he uses. I guess you can kind of see it as like two perspectives on the same phenomena that you're looking at, but that the institutional realm is basically the structure, the constraints on action. And then the realm of action is what is done, what the actors do in the situation. And what he shows is that, okay, from one point in time, the actors follow along, their actions are guided by some sort of a script that basically says that the norms within that institutional setting are that given a set of circumstances, the organization would, or the actors within the organization would behave a certain way. They would do something. So in the case, just to preview, this is the case of the introduction of the technology, for example, and the first interplay between the radiologist and the technologist. So the institutional norms guide them to respond to a condition or a situation or a certain way. It goes up in the action. You get a feedback loop as to whether or not, say, the task was done correctly or the interaction was favorable or disfavorable or whatever. And then it comes back into a change in the institutional norm. Says, all right, if there was a bad outcome, then the norm is going to change through some negotiation between the radiologists and technologists. And then new norm forms, and that's how structure evolves over time. That's my perhaps mediocre attempt to try to explain this loop that he's showing in the diagram.
No, I think you did it quite well, Tom. And it's important to mention that this thinking was not independent of others. Like Steve also acknowledges that on page 81, mentioning Manning's analysis of police officers and how they enact occupational structures of policing, and Riley's study of two subsidiaries of a large corporation, where he investigated the structuring of organizational subworlds or worlds. And you see how that thinking has informed him. What he adds to it is a whole vocabulary and analytical toolkit to study it. And this is where he brings in Goffman. You already mentioned scripts, and it's actually in his book, Work in Technological Change, which he published at Oxford University Press. He gave three lectures at Said Business School when I was working there. And in one of those lectures, he really outlined how Goffman's work has inspired his approach to collecting data, data analysis, how he looks at roles and role relations as having scripts. And that is very nicely illustrated in this paper here, really analyzing the different scripts during different stages of structuring. So prior to a new technology being adopted, during the initial phases, and how that then stabilizes. And I think that's nicely represented in the model that he carves out.
Yeah, I mean, I agree, Greta. That was, Tom, not at all a mediocre attempt. It was a highly proficient attempt at walking us through the model. And Greta, to your point, correct. He goes a step further back, where he first starts with citing social theory that already speaks to this. And so he draws on two specific theories, negotiated order theory, which was the sociologist Anselm Strauss, and who also, if I'm not wrong, studied healthcare settings quite a bit, and structuration theory, which was the British sociologist Anthony Giddens, both of whom wrote kind of most of the theorizing on these topics happened in the 70s. And so he talks about that. He talks about what's common across both of these theories is this metaphor of language and how language changes. So you can think of structure as grammar and action as actual usage. So colloquialisms, the things people say when they interact, and then how grammar will shape what you say. You won't totally break grammar in your conversations. But at the same time, you're always slightly breaking it or moving it around in ways that then later change grammar itself, and things that might not have been okay in previous generations, constructions that might not have been okay are okay as the language itself evolves. And so that kind of almost philosophically, we see it in structuration theory and we see it in negotiated order theory. I almost, you know, thought analogously about Thomas Kuhn and the, you know, perhaps a future episode on scientific revolutions, but the idea of how in practice, slight deviations from a paradigm eventually change the paradigm itself, even if the paradigm informs your practice to begin with. And then, like you said, Greta, he introduces two kind of empirical pieces that have already tested this. So one was in the Manning work and the other was Riley's work. And he then says, what I'm doing is that both of these pieces look at this interaction, this structuration process, but as a kind of a whole, so as a loop in time, in a given snapshot rather, I'm looking at it as an evolution over time. And so that's where we come to the model Tom was explaining, where you've got these phases as well as things are changing and evolving over time. I do think it's very interesting how he structured the paper, no pun intended, with the model beforehand. And I think it's because he then uses that to justify, it's because he is starting with that theoretical lens of structuration. And so it's not as if he decided on that lens. He might have in practice, but for the purpose of this paper, it's not as if structuration is a finding. It's only the details of how it worked and what it means for technology and organizations. So I think he's bringing it up front because he's using that theory already. But B, because he then goes on to really link his methodology very tightly with this model. So essentially he goes on to say, okay, now that we've got this, we need to figure out how to study institution and action. We need to figure out what he calls an empirical fulcrum, this concept of scripts to try to bridge institution and action. We need to figure out how to bracket the phases of when things change. So what is this exogenous shock? And so then all of his methodology kind of follows logically from the conceptual diagram that he's trying to investigate.
Yeah, and perhaps that's a nice leeway to go into the methods and the findings. And I propose to get back to this model after we've done that, because I do have some questions about the model, actually, as I revisited it.
Yeah, that's fair. Let's go into the study itself. And again, this was a comparison of two sites, basically two hospitals, which he codenamed urban and suburban. The only thing that was really truly in common, you know, explicitly in common between the two, is that they're introducing this new scanner, which a CT scanner, and he codenamed all of the technology as well. It's just, the Technicare 2060 is being introduced as this new technology. And so the setting is this: the radiologists were the people whose responsibility was to read and interpret x-rays, and they were the only ones there in both settings. You know, basically you had a very established process by which radiological work was performed. In comes not only this technology to the two hospitals, but also people, technologists was the term used, to run them. And now the technologists were there to run the machine. They were not, at least not initially, programmed to take over any of the responsibilities of the radiologists. That is to say that the CT technologist could provide the results of the scan, but not interpret them, because interpret them would be a diagnostic action by done by a medical professional. So then with that as sort of like the start, then he gets into how the two differed in terms of how the different hospitals approached the integration of the technology with the technologists. And interestingly enough, you know, whereas in the model, you know, he showed that there was an evolution feedback loop, et cetera, what he did find in breaking down the stories of the two, that they actually went through very, very different, not just different phases of how the introduction affected the organization, but that they had different numbers of phases. And so as he's watching and he's going back and forth between the two with a major break in between. He was going back and forth between the two settings for a couple of months, took about a 5-month break, went back later. He found that the way that the story unfolded with the introduction of the technology was very different between the two.
Yeah, and I guess before we jump into the findings, if I get into a bit of the nitty-gritties of the method that he draws out based on his kind of two-lane model. So when I say two-lane for the listener, you know, on top is the realm of action, at the bottom is the realm of the institutional realm, and then you're looking at how things interact between the two, so the structuring process. he starts with the logic of, okay, we have these exogenous changes that will lead to changes in action, but there's always an institutional context to begin with. And so then in terms of method, he talks about how it's important to set, you know, what he calls on page 83, contextually specific baselines. And so what he does in practice is he goes in about 3-4 months before the technology is introduced. I think it was 4 months, Greta is kind of indicating. He goes in 4 months before and maps out how, like, observes interactions in the moment. The other thing he really justifies is how observation is key to this method as well. So he talks about, and I quote, "To map emergent patterns of action and interpretation accurately requires at least partial reliance on participant observation to record who interacts with whom, in what ways, at what times, and to elicit actors' immediate interpretations of events." And he talks about how if you were using kind of interviews where they're recalling it, there might be biases there. If you're using archival data, it might not be recording any of these minute interactional elements. So he talks about how you have to set a baseline, you have to observe interactions. And then he introduces this, again, the word he uses is this empirical fulcrum of the idea of scripts. What that means is you observe interactions and then you abstract out one level from that to kind of the roles. So if I say, for example, Tom told Greta to enter code ABC into the Technicare machine, that's an interaction I've observed. So that's the realm of action. If I see that kind of pattern across multiple people, then it becomes a script of, in this case, let's assume Tom is the radiologist, Greta is the technologist. The script becomes, you know, the radiologist tells the technologist to input specific details or tells them how to use the machine, for example. And then you get the institutional realm, which is further abstraction of, you know, questions like, okay, so the power dynamics between these roles are such that the flow of information is one way or teaching is happening in a covert way. We'll see specifics of this, but the idea is that kind of abstraction. If listeners are drawing a parallel with the Gioia method, I think there is at least in spirit a parallel in terms of you are kind of starting with these very nitty-gritty observations of just recording dialogues between people, abstracting a bit out to the role relations. So the radiologist tells the technologist to do XYZ and abstracting further out to theoretical concepts like power and dependence and things like that. So the third piece, so one piece is just the idea of contextually setting a baseline, and he happens to observe that it's a similar baseline across his two hospitals. The second piece is this scripts, and so abstracting from the action to the script to the institution. And then the third piece is this breaking it up into phases. So like Greta and Tom were saying, he had, for example, different phases in different sites. Because he's not going with kind of a theoretical a priori of phases, but it's more to do with meaningful changes in the technology of work or the structure of the work that then trigger changes in the script and so on.
Yes, and perhaps it's good to mention the amount of fieldwork that went into this study and subsequent publications that he derived from this study. Like, Steve already entered the field 4 months before the technology actually got introduced into these hospitals. To establish that baseline that you spoke about, he went into the field on alternating work days. I think that's also important to mention. So I guess the days in between he used for intermediate data analysis. Often I get questions from graduate students or PhDs like, how much time do I have to spend in the field doing observation? Here you see, like, to really capture the routinization of work practices during a technological change, you need to be in the field for a substantial period of time doing detailed data collection, but also having period of analysis during data collection. In total, he captured 400 complete radiological examinations. As a baseline, I think we forgot to mention that he studied the X-ray, the use of X-rays by radiologists and technicians, because that was an established institutionalized practice within the same department. And the 400 complete radiological examinations included 96 CT scans. So that is about 45 to 50 per hospital. So I think that gives you an indication of how much time he actually invested in the field to come to the insights that he gained. And I think that is also informative for PhD students considering to do qualitative study. It's not just something you do on the side next to your quant assignments. No, you really are committed to invest substantial time in the field. And when you do that, you also see that it pays off, because Steve has, like, you know, numerous papers that have been published out of this data set.
And I think another little detail that I hadn't appreciated before is he talks about how after the observation events, let's say there were almost, you know, 500 of these observation events, he would also interview the people there to get their reflections, to get the interpretation layer. Now, I don't know if he did that after each one, but the point is you further breaking it down into the observation layer and the interpretation layer and gathering both simultaneously is important and impressive work.
Yeah, and for a paper that is relatively short compared to the amount of work going in, there's a lot underlying what came out as the ultimate themes. So, you know, what we're talking about in terms of setting the radiological, you know, the context, he devotes about a page and a half to laying that out, pages 87 and 88, and then goes straight into, without providing numbers or anything, you know, he saves that for the end. But he goes straight into the different, he called them phases. It's a broad brush set of actions and interactions that led to significant change in the relationship between significant structuring on the site. But within each phase, he got into several themes that sort of indicated the phase. So Suburban had two phases, one of which was negotiation of discretion, which is a way of saying that there are all of these consistent patterns of activity related to, okay, what is the role of the technologist in this setting, and how does it relate to the radiologist? And so some of the themes that were there identified as unsought validation, anticipatory questioning, and preference stating. He sort of walks the reader through what those patterns look like. He gives a specific example, but each of these have a whole bunch of examples underlying it. I'll just go on to the first one, unsought validation, to kind of explain how he presents the theme, and then we can kind of bounce around from there. So I'll quote from page 89, as the CT technicians worked to complete their early scans, the first scans with the machine in place, the new technology, they frequently acted without inquiring whether the experienced radiologists thought their action desirable. Usually, the radiologists either failed to note what the technologists had done or chose not to comment on the act. The script of such interactions, skipping out of it, which may be called unsought validation, evidenced the following structure. 1, the technologist took action. 2, the radiologist questioned the action. 3, the technologist provided the justification. And 4, the radiologist confirmed the action as appropriate. So here's an example of a script, of a four-step script in which the technologist was basically doing what they thought was right, but may have been or may not have been according to the radiologist. And so then it was a pattern negotiation, which ultimately led to changes in the way that the technologists operated. So there's an example of the script being applied to how he presents different themes of interactions that he saw.
That's a very nice illustration, Tom. And I think it's good to mention the context here. So when the CT scanner was introduced, they offered 4 days of trainings to technicians and radiologists to know how to use the machine. And of course, that's not enough. It was mostly just describing the technical functionality, but not how to interpret the results whatsoever. Often also the way of learning happened for these professions was on-the-job learning. When we go to the first hospital, Suburban, what happened here is they actually hired some technicians that had expertise in the area of CT scanners. So there were a few that already knew it. And I'm not sure, you have to correct me if I'm wrong, but I think there was like one or two radiologists that got hired that also had some sort of expertise during their residencies with CT scanners. But it felt like here there were more technicians with expertise than radiologists to begin with. And that's where we saw this pattern where they actually try to negotiate discretion, negotiate autonomy, and taking over more responsibility outside of the role patterns that were institutionalized in the department based upon using x-rays.
Yeah, and I think, Greta, you've touched upon a critical thing here, which at some points Barley does make explicit, but the personnel composition is a big driver of the entire different processes of structuring that we see across the two hospitals. In the first case, there are quite a few experienced technologists, and there are at least two inexperienced radiologists. And in fact, what we see from phase one to phase two is that there's a staffing rotation that leads to the experienced technologists working more with the inexperienced radiologists that then allow for some of this usurping of the autonomy. Whereas in the urban hospital case, there's a lot more experienced radiologists, so they kind of maintain their not just their dominance and authority, but also their claim to the expertise of the Technicare instrument. In fact, in the urban hospital is where you see things like taking over the controls of the equipment by the radiologists. So I think there is a huge driver here is just the composition of the personnel in terms of, sure, you've got your different status hierarchy and authority hierarchy already. That's the baseline. But the expertise distribution changes based on the two hospitals.
And I guess the beauty of it is that the counterintuitive finding is that the learning happened the best when these roles became more fluid. When they just enacted, like in the urban case, their traditional role patterns, it took a long time before the technologists actually learned to use the machines.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And he walks us through those different scripts in the first phase of where the technologists abided by the norms. I mean, they basically negotiated within recognizing that the radiologists still had the dominant role, even though the inexperienced radiologists weren't necessarily sure what to do, but the technologists didn't try to steamroll the radiologist either. They abided by the norm and said, all right, they would ask questions. This was the anticipatory question. Okay, we're kind of expecting the radiologist to direct something. So do you want me to do something? To which the radiologist would say, oh yeah, that's okay. And then that would be another way of empowering the technologists to do what they're supposed to do. They also did it in a declaratory fashion, preference stating. So then as this went on, then phase two, the actual usurping of autonomy, this is where, say, the technologists started to, I don't want to say flex their muscles, but you started to see a little bit more of a role reversal where the knowledge that was held by the technologists, I guess, became more and more a tool of the technologists becoming more dominant. So he talks about clandestine teaching, where the technologists started to educate the radiologists in ways that the radiologists didn't necessarily always like. The role reversal, which is where a radiologist started to ask technologists about interpretation of the scan. Before, the radiologists had all of the interpretation, but because the technologists themselves started to learn more about how their scans were being used, started to become pseudo-experts in the interpretation side. And then ultimately, when the radiologists started to get frustrated or whatever, you started to, Barley identified this blaming the technologist theme, in which none was more indicative of how the interaction order had changed than the tendency for radiologists to mistake machine problems for a technologist's incompetence. So when the radiologists didn't get what they wanted or didn't, like, they felt like the technologists were undermining them, like in either intentionally making mistakes or that the technology was failing if they didn't get the perfect interpretation or perfect data that they needed for their interpretation, which really showed how the structure between the radiologists and the technologists had changed.
Yeah, and I think what I found very interesting in phase one of the suburban hospital was this kind of dual aspect to all the scripts where there's a performative element and then what's happening at the information level. The, you know, when whether you're doing unsought validation or you're doing anticipatory questioning, there's always like a maintenance of the appearance of things while expertise is being claimed by the lower status actor. And Barley makes that explicit in Unsought Validation. He says, the script subtly maintained the radiologist's dominant role, while it also affirmed both parties' expertise at neither's expense. So trying to kind of maintain almost the ego of the high power person while affirming your own expertise. Similar with anticipatory question, Barley says it maintained the veneer of deference, but while still again validating the technologist's expertise. What changed in phase two, which led to the role reversal, I think again is that staffing change, the personnel change. And in fact, Barley even says, at first, so this is now in phase two, when you've gone from just the experienced radiologists to a rotation between experienced and inexperienced radiologists, Barley says, at first, the technologists tried to enact scripts that had evolved during the first phase of the scanner's operation, but former interaction patterns were quickly transformed as role relations between radiologists and technologists shifted. So they tried to continue with things like unsought validation and anticipatory questioning, but it was only when the expertise difference became so clear that, okay, these radiologists really need our help and they don't seem to know what's going on, when it was the inexperienced radiologists, that they would start with things like clandestine teaching, but eventually leading to straight up role reversals.
What I liked here is that he also mentions how stressful this was for both occupational groups. Like, this is something that was... I'm just thinking about the Abbott recording we made, where we also talked about, how professions and jurisdictions came into being. But here, these jurisdictional boundaries are becoming blurred. And it really generates, these role reversals generate anxiety. And he has this nice quote here on page 93... after one incident, the radiologist rushed away awkwardly out of the room and the technologist nervously confided to the author, "I don't like it when doctors ask me what a film means. It's not my job to tell them how to do their job." I thought that was a really nice quote.
It was a nice quote. I highlighted that myself. I also highlighted kind of like the summary at the end of the Suburban case, because that, I mean, as anxiety, hostility, and disdain, now that was interesting, increased, both technologists and radiologists acted to reduce their occurrence. So now what we're seeing as an end result to this phase is that the two sides are starting to build not just stress, but also barriers between themselves. The two communities are starting to split. And so the technologists began to take responsibility for routine decisions, where in the past they would have consulted a radiologist beforehand. You see that fracture happening, and that in itself starts to introduce further scripting to formalize, okay, so then this is what the technology does or technologist does, and this is when we will seek to interact with the radiologist, which is going to be a minimal as opposed to a continuous effort. So the phase may end in Barley's paper, but you can see how the structuration continues on and on and on into the future. Maybe we can jump to the Urban case, or?
Sounds good.
Okay, so now the Urban case, again, it was very similar in terms of the same technology being introduced, but to highlight what was said about the setting, there were different actors, or the different levels of experience with radiologists, and perhaps a different approach to the integration, which led to a very, very different outcome of what types of interactions were found. So Urban mobilized to meet the problem of the lack of experience by having knowledgeable radiologists drive the train. Okay, so 2 months before the scanner arrived, Urban hired a young radiologist who had specialized in CT scanning during his residency. And a second radiologist charged with organizing the scanner operations was a longtime member of the department who dominated Urban's head scanner and who had followed the body scanning literature. So in this particular setting now, what they're going to do is they're going to put the whole onus on these two radiologists to lead the effort. And so what you'll have is that it's a bit more directive from those radiologists how things are going to get done. So as opposed to the more negotiated phase one in Suburban's case, urban experienced a very different dynamic as the technology was introduced.
And while phase one here is called negotiating dependence, I guess it would almost be negotiating independence, right?
Yeah, I mean, totally agreed. And I think what was actually interesting to me, again, reading between the lines, just the way that in suburban hospital, what I found interesting was the art of this maintaining deference while taking your autonomy or making your expertise clear and getting more discretion. In urban, what was interesting was not even, let's say, the first layer of, okay, there's a lot more direction giving and direction seeking and a lot more one-way flow of information and the power dynamic stays as it is. But what's happening in the kind of second order effect, which is an almost learned helplessness, although he doesn't use that phrase, by the technologists, where they start to kind of rely on, and that's the idea of negotiating dependence on the radiologists for their own, what they have expertise on. In fact, on page 97, so towards the end of phase one, Barley says, "Tellingly, by the third week of operation, Dex ceased to inquire what should be done and instead began to ask each other, what did he say he wanted?" So you go from this more problem focus on, okay, what needs to be done in this case, to like, what did the boss say he wanted? And there was this, almost a two-way loop in that sense.
And the example that he gave in the subsection on direction giving, you can kind of see how that pattern of interaction would have occurred, because it's basically an example of a radiologist telling the technologist exactly what to do, even though the radiologist may not actually know the technology to do the right thing. He's spelling things out for the technologist. And over time, the technologist just either rebel in a way, countermand is the word he used, or it just simply degenerated further. The usurping the controls, for example, radiologists literally took the scanner's controls away from the technologists at the console. Can you imagine how that is going to be felt by the technologist, where you just get out of my way, I know what I'm doing-ish, and off you go. So then, not surprisingly, you had a major rift between the two where they just were not working properly together. And so then phases two and three, which he sort of combined for this paper, they were called constructing and ensuring ineptitude. That's the helplessness, or the term you use, Rowan, for just basically the technologists were not performing what they were supposed to be doing and did not feel empowered to do their jobs.
Correct. And learned helplessness being the idea that you're enacting your own helplessness as well. And that comes out particularly in phase two and three, because it starts with actually a change in work practice, in the sense that the radiologists start to spend more time just in their office and not in the CT room and the control room. And Barley says, ironically, the radiologists' retreat signaled the second phase of structuring that actually amplified the technologist's dependence. You could have imagined in other settings that the retreat then forces the technologist to kind of start, sink or swim on their own and gain that confidence. But they actually get even more worried about what happens when the radiologist leaves the office and comes to the control room to see what's going on. The other interesting thing that came up in my reading in this phase two and three, specifically in the accusatory questions script, he says, so the example in an instance of the script is where a radiologist enters the control room, so comes from his office, enters the control room and says, "What have you been doing all this time?" And then Barley says, as was usually the case in such encounters, the tech responded meekly. She told the radiologist she had encountered a technical problem, but she didn't mention she knew the problem arose from his earlier request. In my reading, this was the first time I saw the female pronoun being used, and that immediately then brought up the question of, were there kind of systematic differences in the gender of the technologists across the hospital? It's not clear necessarily from his findings. One could argue that this, again, that intersectional nature of low power, low status in multiple domains of life either make you more lean into learned helplessness. One could also argue they make you act like the technologists in phase one, who know how to maintain that veneer of deference while still claiming their expertise. But either ways, it was just very interesting, because I feel like reviewers today would be very curious about what are the demographic differences that might be also affecting the two different trajectories in the two different hospitals in terms of interaction patterns.
Yes, I think that that's a very nice observation. I also noticed it here. What I miss in the findings, or in this case, is that radiologists completely seem unaware that they failed to train the technicians by the way they behaved during phase one. And so the fact that the technicians became completely dependent on them and how they tried to break that pattern was also completely, you know, useless. And it's only in phase four where Barley says, like, here we see like a type of learning happening, a type of behavior that was kind of similar to suburban phase one. So here you see that the entire traditional way of enacting role structures prevented the learning, leading to long delays in the technicians actually becoming skilled in using the machines compared to the suburban case.
And again, you see the almost preeminence of the personnel composition factor. So what triggers phase four in urban is that the inexperienced radiologists also start to rotate in. So similar to, I guess, phase two of suburban as well, when the usurping autonomy happens in suburban. And Barley, again, is explicit about this. He says, by redistributing the relative balance of practical experience in favor of the remaining technologists, it triggers this fourth phase. So I think if one were to, you know, there's a lot of richness in these scripts and the details, but if one were to try to reduce to like the almost a reductionist view of in what circumstance would we expect which kinds of role relations, you can bring it down to that phrase on page 99 of the relative balance of practical experience. So where does the relative balance of practical experience lie, with the technologists or the radiologists?
And so the end result, interestingly, seems like the two hospitals wound up roughly in the same place, but they got there from very, very different ways. And the end result, you know, there's enough differences at the end of this particular study to show that the structures of the two hospitals, despite the same introduction of the technologies and a lot of the same interactions, like the change in the rotation of experienced and inexperienced radiologists, some of the same activities taking place, you saw two different processes, two different outcomes, all using the same script pattern. So in a way, this sort of validates what he says about the interplay of action and institution.
No, I was just going to finish that point, but that idea, it brings home the, if we zoom back out, it brings home the idea that the same technology, in this case, it's the exact same maker, vendor, equipment, you know, the Technica 2060, in two hospitals that had the same patterns of work as well between radiologists and technologists, can trigger these very different trajectories, because the technology isn't just an exogenous variable that, you know, X leads to Y. The technology is just a disruptive occasion that triggers this structuring process, but the process can go in different directions based on other factors like interaction patterns or staffing rotas and so on.
And that concludes the episode for today. Thank you for listening. The views expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect those of their respective organizations or institutions. We hope that you enjoyed the conversation and found it valuable. If so, please consider subscribing through your favorite podcast service and you won't miss an episode. We also welcome your feedback, so if you liked or didn't like something, or have a correction or suggestion for us, please get in touch with us via LinkedIn, Facebook, X, or our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Also, please consider contributing to the program by buying us a coffee at www.buyusacoffee.com/TAOP. That's www.buyusacoffee.com/TAOP. Your support is greatly appreciated, as it allows us to continue providing great conversations about the classics of organization studies. Again, thank you for listening, and we hope to see you for the conclusion of this episode here on Talking About Organizations.